7th, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina. We bring news and information from around the world, country, state, and triangle to listeners who are blind and print impaired. Our broadcasts are received from Wilmington to Winston-Salem over specially tuned radio receivers and via the internet at www.ncreadingservice.org. All news is read as printed. Our first hour covers news, editorials, and comments of statewide interest. Your readers today are Karen Edwards and Tom Bolton. We will begin with the weather report for today, May 7th, and a few days later. Today is 81 is a high, a real feel of 86. UV index is going to be high, 9, so watch out. It says beautiful with clouds and sun. Tonight, it may be a shower late in the evening and a low of 60 degrees. Tomorrow, back to pretty nice, sunny and clouds, a thunderstorm or two, a high of 83, a low in the evening of 61. Again, UV index will be a 9, which is about as high as it can get. Friday, cloudy with thunderstorms and spots, high of 78, low of 51. It'll be safer for the sunshine because the UV on that day is a 3. So we're going to go from beautiful today to possible some storms later tomorrow to clouds with thunderstorms and spots on Friday. Saturday clears up, sun through high clouds, a high of 72 and a low of 53. Saturday sounds beautiful, so does Sunday. It's mostly cloudy, but a high of 76. So some rain, but a lot of good temperatures this week. Our front page of the News and Observer for today, May 7th, has four articles. The top article says, judge orders NC to certify Riggs as election winner. That's in the Supreme Court race, and we will read that article. On the right side of the page, there is an article that says, North Carolina House bill would restrict basic income programs. This will be read also. The middle has a picture of people who are building shelters up in the mountains of North Carolina. And the article is only 6 units occupied in trailer housing program after Helene. We'll read that. And then at the bottom, there's a small picture also of up in the mountains of the Helene damage. And the bottom article is News and Observer named Pulitzer Prize finalist for Helene coverage. Okay, we'll start with our articles from the front page. And Karen,
we'll do the first one.
Yes, let's start with News and Observer. Charlotte Observer named Pulitzer Prize finalist for Helene coverage. The News and Observer and the Charlotte Observer were named finalists for this prize Monday, a top journalism honor given for their joint coverage of Hurricane Helene's destruction across western North Carolina. The winners were announced from Columbia University in New York, with the NNO and the Charlotte Observer recognized in the breaking news category. The Pulitzer for breaking news went to the Washington Post for its coverage of the July attempt to assassinate then-presidential candidate Donald Trump. Along with the North Carolina newspapers, the Associated Press was also named as a prize finalist for breaking news awarded for its work on the Trump shooting. Hurricane Helene struck the mountain counties of western North Carolina in late September, killing more than 100 people and damaging more than 70,000 homes. Journalists with the Raleigh and Charlotte newspapers worked in areas suffering without power, water, cellular service, or passable roads, providing daily stories, photographs, and video that combated widespread misinformation about the storm. The toll that Helene took on western North Carolina was unprecedented, and the News and Observer and the Charlotte Observer worked together closer than ever to document it, said Thad Ogburn, managing director of the News and Observer. We told the personal stories of lives lost. We fact-checked the many falsehoods, and we showed readers images of devastation that were hard to fathom. In the first week, the newspapers published more than 100 articles and scores of photos and videos seen by millions of people. Journalists from both publications often filed their stories and images using cell phones, often parked in their cars outside storm-stricken town hall buildings with a Starlink connection. NNO photojournalist Travis Long covered the storm's aftermath for 16 days without a break, staying in a house without power for 9 of those. At the core of our mission as journalists is being there for our communities in moments of great crisis, said Rana Cash, executive editor of the Charlotte Observer. Our North Carolina neighbors, severely impacted by Helene, were vulnerable in every way imaginable. It was our responsibility and privilege to provide coverage that helped them endure this great tragedy. The Charlotte Observer and the News and Observer joined our resources, journalistic muscle, and compassion to tell stories with urgency and illuminate the great needs of the region, she continued. This is a testament to our collective determination to serve. The Pulitzer Prize is widely considered the highest honor in U.S. journalism, awarded for exceptional reporting, commentary, and storytelling. The NNO last won the prize in 1996 for its public service reporting on the Boss Hog series that examined the consequences of the fast-growing pork industry in eastern North Carolina. The Charlotte Observer won its last prize in 2014 when Kevin Sears was honored for editorial cartooning. Other Pulitzer wins for Raleigh are its 2000 finalist award for work on Hurricane Floyd, its prize for criticism in 1989, which went to Michael Scooby, and former editor Claude Sitton's 1983 Pulitzer for commentary. Charlotte's other awards include being a finalist in 2013 for an investigation into nonprofit hospitals, its 2008 finalist honors in the public service category for covering of the regional mortgage and housing crisis, being named a finalist in 1995 for an examination into Charlotte's declining inner city, its 1988 public service Pulitzer for reporting on the PTL television industry and the misuse of funds, and its 1981 public service award for reporting on brown lung in textile mills. Chuck Stone, a longtime journalist professor at UNC Chapel Hill, who died in 2014, also received a special citation from the committee for his groundbreaking work as a journalist covering the civil rights movement. His pioneering role as the first black columnist at the Philadelphia Daily News, later syndicated to nearly 100 publications, and for co-founding the National Association of Black Journalists 50 years ago. Kathleen Duvall, a history professor at UNC Chapel Hill, won a Pulitzer Prize in the history category of letters and drama for her book, Native Nations, A Millennium in North America. The category awards a distinguished and appropriately documented book on the history of the United States. The committee said Native Nations gives a panoramic portrait of Native American nations and communities over 1,000 years, a vivid and accessible account of their endurance, ingenuity, and achievement in the face of conflict and dispossession.
Our second front page article, in a ruling that could put an end to nearly 6 months of legal battles over North Carolina's contested Supreme Court election, a federal judge on Monday ruled against the Republican candidate's effort to overturn his narrow loss. Chief U.S. District Judge Richard E. Myers, in an appointment of President Donald Trump, ruled that Jefferson Griffin, a judge on the State Court of Appeals, cannot, quote, change the rules of the game after it had been played, end quote. Myers ordered the state not to throw out any votes and to certify the results of the election as they were at the close of the canvass period, with Democratic incumbent Allison Riggs winning by 734 votes. Today we won, Riggs said in a statement. I'm proud to continue upholding the Constitution and the rule of law as North Carolina's Supreme Court Justice. However, Myers has put his own order on hold for 7 days to give Griffin a chance to appeal. Griffin and the North Carolina Republican Party, which joined him in litigating the case, did not provide a statement Monday evening, but said they were reviewing the ruling and determining next steps. In a 68-page ruling, Myers said Griffin and the North Carolina GOP's unprecedented effort to challenge over 65,000 ballots presented an unconstitutional burden on the right to vote. Quoting, "This case concerns whether the federal constitution permits a state to alter the rules of an election after the fact and apply those changes retroactively to only a select group of voters, and in so doing, treat those voters differently than other similarly situated individuals," he wrote. Quoting again, "This case is also about whether a state may redefine its class of eligible voters but offer no process to those who may have been misclassified as ineligible. To this court, the answer to each of those questions is no." End of quote. Riggs' win has been blocked for months as Griffin's case has wound its way through state and federal courts. In April, the state Supreme Court threw out Griffin's largest challenge, but ruled that potentially thousands of military and overseas voters would have to prove their eligibility during a 30-day ballot review process, known as the cure period. Several hundred other voters challenged over their residency status wouldn't have their votes canceled without the chance, would have had their votes canceled without the chance to cure them or prove that they were legal votes. Myers' decision, if it stands, means that the cure period will not begin and no votes will be discarded. Griffin and the NCGOP are likely to appeal Myers' ruling to the Fourth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals, though that court has already ruled against their efforts once. The case could ultimately reach the U.S. Supreme Court. How did we get here? In a chaotic, months-long campaign, Griffin has attempted to discard tens of thousands of voters cast in the race in the hopes that it could flip the result in his favor. The litigation has ping-ponged between state and federal courts and drawn national attention from critics who warned that his effort, if successful, could form the playbook for challenging legitimate election results across the whole country. While Griffin initially challenged over 65,000 ballots, the number of votes in contention were significantly reduced by the Republican-dominated North Carolina Supreme Court last month when it rejected his largest challenge, which dealt with voters who didn't have certain identifying numbers in the state's registration database. The court ruled that this omission, which affected over 60,000 of the challenged voters, was likely not the voters' fault and therefore could not be used to cancel their ballots. However, in a 4-2 decision, the Supreme Court ordered that potentially thousands of military and overseas voters would have to show their IDs during a 30-day cure period or risk having their votes thrown out. In his ruling, Myers noted that the state had approved an exception to the ID requirement for military and overseas voters that was in place for months before the election, but was never challenged until after the election. He also noted that Griffin only challenged these votes in 6 of North Carolina's 100 counties, all of which lean Democratic. This is a quote again from Judge Myers. "When the underlying basis for a protest is a rule that applies statewide, a geographically selective protest raises equal protection concerns and the specter of post-election mischief," Myers wrote. Again, he's a judge appointed by a Republican president, Donald Trump. Under the state Supreme Court's order, a smaller group of voters who were challenged for their residency status would also have had their ballots discarded without a chance to cure them. Reporting from Anderson Alerts and Popular Information found reason to believe that dozens of these voters, who Griffin argues had never resided in the state, were actually long-term North Carolina residents. Citing this, Meyer said that the court's order to cancel these votes posed a serious risk of disenfranchising eligible voters. Monday's ruling comes after Myers initially declined to stop the cure period from happening. When Riggs first appealed the Supreme Court's order to Myers, he said he would review the case before a winner was certified, but would not stop the cure process from beginning. Riggs appealed to the Fourth Circuit, which agreed to issue a stay halting that cure period, at least until Myers could rule on the merits of the case. While briefing commenced in the federal court, Griffin began arguing in state court about the scope of the court-ordered cure period, contending that election officials' plans to implement it were not expansive enough. The State Board of Elections' plan for carrying out the cure period would have affected 1,675 voters at most. Griffin, however, argued that more ballots, potentially over 5,000, should be brought into question, and that the challenged voters should have fewer opportunities to fix their ballots. When Republicans took control of the election board last week for the first time in nearly a decade, some raised concerns that they could use their newfound majority to tilt the cure process in Griffin's favor. Myers' orders, however, is clear in its instruction to scrap the cure period and to certify Riggs as the victor.
Thank you, Tom. This article, North Carolina's Helene plan made 1,000 trailers available. Why have only 6 been filled? This is a very long article, so I will be editing it somewhat along the way. One day, after taking office, Governor Josh Stein stood in Asheville and signed an executive order meant to jumpstart the supply of temporary housing for those unable to go home due to damage from Helene. The order authorized the Department of Public Safety to buy up to 1,000 travel trailers or mobile homes for storm-hit counties and waived certain state bidding rules to speed things along. The state also secured full FEMA reimbursement for units purchased through March 24th, with the state covering 10% of costs after that. They are available to people unable to return home for 6 months. While we are not losing focus on our longer-term rebuilding goals, I want to reiterate that people need temporary housing now, the governor said at the time. 4 months later, however, only 6 state-purchased trailers have been installed and are occupied. The program is still active and ready to help, with no households on a wait list and no challenges experienced in terms of building and deploying the units. So why did so few of these trailers be used? According to DPS, it comes down to a lack of interest. The state contacted more than 3,000 disaster survivors, but found not much interest in participating in the program. Disappointment over not being able to keep the trailers, distrust of government programs, and factored into survivors' decisions, the FEMA criteria also played a role. FEMA has limits for building on a floodplain. It also must ensure proper utility hookups for water, sewer, and electricity, and in working order, before anyone can move into a temporary housing unit, according to FEMA's description of its Direct Temporary Housing Assistance Program, which provides mobile homes and trailers. The NNO asked FEMA on April 24th about the requirements the state trailer project was subject to, but FEMA deferred to the state. Prior to publication, Graney did not reply to multiple inquiries on what exactly FEMA requirements and guidelines the state is subject to or opted to follow. After the story published, a FEMA representative said the state had its own set of qualifications and requirements for its sheltering program that allows the state to place units without having to abide by FEMA's direct housing program. It's not that that housing program requirements played a part in the state's minimal success placing trailers, the email said. The NNO again reached out to state officials, but has not received further clarification. Representative Dudley Green, a Republican lawmaker who represents various Western North Carolina counties, on April 23rd said the lack of uptake for the state program is not necessarily a lack of need for temporary housing. FEMA has helped more than 159,000 households statewide with financial assistance for help with repairs, rent, personal property loss, and other needs. In addition to placing more than 13,200 families in hotels through the traditional transitional sheltering assistance program, it has provided 242 temporary housing units statewide. The agency tries to place temporary housing units on survivors' private property whenever possible, but the site must meet space, safety, and utility requirements. Alternately, units can be put on sites such as campgrounds, but FEMA warns in its website that can take longer due to land leases and site work. Representative Jeffrey McNeely, a Republican representing Iredell County, questioned at the January hearing whether FEMA's utility hookup requirements hinder uptake. Meanwhile, Representative Mark Pless, a Republican representing Haywood and Madison counties, criticized the state's promotion of 1,000 trailers when floodplain restrictions limited placements. Jonathan Krebs, Stein's disaster recovery advisor, noted then that many survivors contacted by the state were open to mobile homes or trailers if titled in their names, as some nonprofits offer. The state trailer program, like the FEMA trailer program, also requires meeting with the disaster case manager monthly to monitor the progress of their damaged home. Nonprofits have had more success filling finding people to take trailers. North American Ministries for Samaritan's Purse, which relies on private donations rather than government funding, has delivered 143 campers to people in need after Helene and has 14 more to distribute, said Harrison, a vice president of the organization. But at this stage of recovery efforts, Samaritan's Purse is now focusing more on repairing or replacing homes. This includes providing mobile homes. Harrison said 256 families have requested new mobile homes, with 10 already on site and being hooked up to utilities and undergoing inspections. These homes, available in 2- and 3-bedroom models, are titled in the family's names and often placed on the sites of their former homes. In some cases, families have had to purchase new lots, he said. The state is also working to address long-term needs. Stein, on April 25th, announced the Trump administration had signed off on the state's plan for deploying $1.4 billion in housing and urban development block grants. Of that amount, $860.7 million would go toward repairing or replacing owner-occupied homes, with remaining dollars to help with rental housing needs, infrastructure, and more. Devin Taylor, director of Cabins for Christ, said temporary housing remains a pressing need in western North Carolina. His group has placed over 250 households in campers or cabins. About 70 to 80% of the families his group helped are still in temporary housing. He heard from many that had it not been for churches and businesses across the state and nation that came to aid, quote, we would not have been able to provide the level of shelter that they did. Housing needs differ by region, Taylor said. In Asheville, more families are beginning to seek permanent housing, but rural areas remain far behind in this recovery. Buncombe County spokesperson Cassie Day said more than 180 permits for temporary housing have been issued, with 72 of those FEMA permits. The remainder are split between private property owners and nonprofits, but has not been broken down. The need for temporary shelter remains as families work through repairs and await rebuilding. Canton Mayor Smathers, who has noted several obstacles to Helene recovery, agrees people are still in need. He sees some people living in damaged homes. It's unclear if the families have insurance to cover repair costs or have the means to rebuild themselves, he said.
thank you for going through that long and very crucial article for North Carolina, where we're at with the mountain repairs. In 2022, the city of Durham launched one of the state's first guaranteed income programs, offering cash payments to people returning to Durham after prison. For almost a year, the Excel program gave 109 people $600 a month with no strings attached to help them re-enter society. Although the pilot program ended in 2023, some Durham City Council members have pushed for some kind of guaranteed income program to continue, with Mayor Pro Tem Mark Anthony Middleton proposing $1 million in city money. The $500,000 Excel pilot program was funded partly by a grant from Mayors for Guaranteed Income. The results were incredibly positive, Middleton said in an interview, quoting, folks use the money for bills, to get job interviews. The recidivism rate of the people who participated was close to zero. However, a new bill introduced by a Republican state lawmaker could threaten such initiatives, program supporters say. House Bill 859, currently moving through House committees, would prohibit cities and counties from implementing guaranteed income programs unless authorized by local or general state laws, which would require approval at the General Assembly. The bill, sponsored by State Representative Cody Honeycutt of Montgomery and Stanley counties, was approved on April 29th in the House Committee on Commerce and Economic Development and referred to the House Committee on State and Local Government. The bill has several more steps before it reaches the House and Senate floors for a vote. So nothing has been passed on this yet. The News and Observer reached out to Honeycutt through email and a phone call last week, but got no response. Guaranteed income programs are designed to provide a financial safety net, and many local governments across the country have been testing them. In 2023, there were about 100 programs across the United States. The largest, which ended in 2023 in Chicago, gave 5,000 households $500 a month for a year. Advocates say people who receive the money pay for necessities like housing, food, and utility bills, as well as transportation to get to work and child care. The Magnolia Mothers Trust, which gave poor black mothers $1,000 a month in Jackson, Mississippi, saw a dramatic increase in women being able to buy food and have money left over for emergencies. Durham County is planning to launch the DCO Thrives, Durham County Thrives, with the Durham Children's Initiative, which will give 125 families $750 a month for a year. Qualifying families must make below 30% of the year of the area median income, or $31,750 for a four-person household. County Manager Claudia Hager said the pilot program would serve families who are hardworking residents who struggle to afford housing, food, child care, and utilities despite being employed. Quoting Hager, Durham County opposes House Bill 859. While the future of the DCO Thrives pilot faces uncertainty due to potential legislative restrictions and funding challenges, Durham County remains steadfast and our commitment to supporting residents in need through whatever lawful mechanisms remain available to us. Earlier this year, Raleigh launched Bringing Neighbors Home, a program that will pay 45 families and individuals experiencing homelessness at least $1,450 every month for 2 years to spend however they see fit. Quoting Emily Sutton, the city's housing and neighborhood director, she said, we know through years of research and practice that a large majority of people, 80 to 90% of people, just need that 2 years of assistance, and then they're able to stabilize on their own after that time. Critics of guaranteed income programs say the programs, the payments, could discourage people from working and don't contribute to reducing overall costs. In an article, Doug McKay, a professor in UNC's public policy department, said there is a reciprocity worry about the programs. One of the responses to this is that UBI recognizes all those forms of contribution to society that aren't remunerated, he added. Think about parents taking care of their children or poor people taking care of elderly family members. There's lots of ways in which people contribute to society. Middleton said the programs are a matter of principle and that economically secure people and stable people make better neighbors when they aren't trying to figure out how to pay bills or feed children. Poor people work more than just about anybody else in the country, he said. Many of these people piece together two and three jobs to make ends meet. The notion that we are seeing people just getting checks and staying at home is not what the data is bearing out, Middleton said. How cities with guaranteed income programs will respond if the bill becomes law is unknown. There is no comments yet about things that are still in the process, but we'll have more information as this goes through the General Assembly. The purpose of the North Carolina Reading Service is to connect people who are blind and print impaired to each other and the community by delivering news, information, and entertainment using the latest audio technology. To receive more information, please visit our website at www.ncreadingservice.org or call us at 919-832-5138. Again, our phone number is 919-832-5138. We now move to a couple opinion pieces from the News and Observer. Karen.
North Carolina's most powerful politician now has something to prove. This is by Andrew Dunn. One after another, State Senator Phil Berger has started rolling out endorsements from allies old and new. Agricultural Commissioner Steve Troxler, State Auditor Dave Bolick, the sheriff from Alamance County, even former legislators. All standard fare in campaign season, but it's May of an odd-numbered year. The next General Assembly election is still 10 months away. Ordinarily, this is the time for legislation and budget negotiations, not public campaigning. But Berger isn't treating this like a typical off year. He's not acting like the politician who has coasted through re-election after re-election without breaking a sweat. He's acting like someone with something to prove. And that's because, for the first time in a long time, Phil Berger has a real race on his hands. Since the first winning his Senate seat in 2000, Berger has rarely faced serious opposition. That freedom has given him space not just to legislate, but to build. Today, he doesn't just lead the Senate. He sets the agenda for the legislature, controls the campaign dollars that power swing seat Republicans, and directs a political machine that touches nearly every major decision in state government. When a bill gets written, a judge gets picked, or a council of state seat opens up, Berger is involved. Often, decisively. But that long stretch without competition may have come at a cost. While Berger was shaping the state to his liking, his ties to his home turf in Rockingham County began to fray. Now, for the first time in more than a decade, he's being forced to look back. This year's challenge comes from Sheriff Sam Page, a fellow Republican with deep local roots and a sizable following among conservatives. Page has served as Rockingham County Sheriff since 1998, cultivating a reputation as a tough, on-crime, pro-Trump lawman who's never shied away from a fight. He considered challenging Berger in 2024, but stepped aside and instead launched a run for lieutenant governor. He didn't come close statewide, but in Rockingham County he dominated. That's not new. In 2014, Berger won 59% of the county vote. Page, on the same ballot, earned 76%. A flawed but telling 2023 poll showed Page starting a primary race with a lead. The warning signs haven't stopped. Last year, Berger's son, Kevin, a county commissioner and close political ally, barely survived a primary challenge, winning by just 3 votes. Voters in Rockingham know both men well, and in a political climate growing more hostile to entrenched power, Page may offer the contrast local Republicans didn't know they wanted until now. Over the years, Berger's influence has become more than legislative. Through appointments, budgets, and legal power, the Berger family has embedded itself in nearly every layer of government, all anchored in a single rural district. But that level of reach creates distance. And in 2023, the cracks started to show. Berger backed a plan to bring casino gambling to 4 locations across North Carolina, including a site in Rockingham County. The response was immediate. Residents packed public meetings. Lawsuits followed. Political allies became critics. Page emerged as one of the plan's most vocal opponents. Even supporters of the idea expressed frustration with the process, opaque, rushed, and largely detached from local input. It was a rare public misstep for a politician known for always being 2 moves ahead, and it deepened a perception that had been building for years. Berger was no longer the small-town lawyer from Eden, but a Raleigh power broker who had lost touch with the voters who sent him there. Berger isn't behaving like someone expecting a sleepy primary. The early endorsements, new email letters, a spike in sponsored legislation, it's the kind of retail politics he hasn't needed in years, maybe decades. And when Page suggested Berger might try to revive the gambling bill this season, the pushback came swiftly. Unlike Sam Page, Senator Berger is neither a liar nor a political opportunist. Berger's campaign spokesperson told the News and Observer in February, and unlike Sam Page, when Senator Berger says something, voters can believe it. That's not a quote you give when you're feeling confident. The old rule in politics still holds. If you're not worried, you ignore the criticism. If you are, you punch back. Berger still holds every advantage that matters. The fundraising network and institutional loyalty and the tools of legislative power. But this time, that may not be enough. To keep his seat, he'll have to campaign like he means it and like he remembers what it feels like to fight for votes. Because this time, the outcome is not guaranteed. Andrew Dunn is a contributing columnist to the Charlotte Observer and the News and Observer of Raleigh. He's a conservative political analyst and the publisher of Longleaf Politics, a newsletter dedicated to weighing in on the big issues in North Carolina government and politics. Tom?
Thank you. Second opinion piece, Jefferson Griffin's relentless bid to overturn the North Carolina Supreme Court race that he lost by 730 votes, may finally be over. A federal judge finally ruled Monday, 6 months after the election day, that the state must certify Allison Riggs' victory. But what was particularly striking about the ruling is that it came from a conservative Chief U.S. District Judge Richard E. Myers. The judge who issued the ruling is a Donald Trump appointee. Myers' ruling was clear. Griffin and his Republican allies have no right to change the rules of an election that has already occurred. To do so would violate the due process and equal protection rights of the affected voters, he ruled. That principle will be familiar to anyone who has ever played a sport or a board game. You establish the rules before the game, Myers wrote. You don't change them after the game is done. It really is that simple. Yet it seems to be a principle that Republican judges in North Carolina cannot or refuse to grasp. 2 Republican judges on the North Carolina Court of Appeals ruled that more than 60,000 voters should have had to prove their identities within 15 days or lose their right to vote. A Republican-dominated North Carolina Supreme Court said those votes should stand, but left the door open to throwing out thousands of other votes from overseas voters and so-called never residents, despite the fact that those never residents were erroneously labeled as such. Pretending there is even an ounce of merit in Griffin's ridiculous scheme to overturn an election is shameful. The sole Republican judge to defend the rule of law in North Carolina is Republican Justice Richard Dietz, who has remained steadfast in his belief that rewriting the rules of an election after the election is unlawful and unwise. Resisting the pressures of partisanship in North Carolina is no easy feat these days, and his courage should be commended. Outside of North Carolina, however, Griffin's crusade is over. North Carolina may be a state where Republicans get to do whatever they want to do, but federal judges aren't willing to participate in what is essentially a judicial coup. Griffin can appeal his ruling to the U.S. Court of Appeals, but they shouldn't expect a different result there. That court has already ruled against the argument once. It's yet another reminder of how baldly and awfully partisan judges in North Carolina have become. The depth and diversity of people who know this lawsuit has no merit is incredible. It includes voters from both parties, election officials of all political stripes, military leaders, and hundreds of judges, government officials, and attorneys from across the political spectrum. And now a Trump-appointed federal judge has agreed. It's North Carolina's Republican judges who are the extreme outliers. Republicans cannot lament a rogue judiciary or overreach by radical left judges. They cannot accuse the judge who issued their ruling of partisan bias, although they may still try. This is a conservative judge appointed by Donald Trump. He is a member of the Conservative Federalist Society and the National Rifle Association. Is exactly the kind of judge Republicans would hope or expect to side with them. But he isn't. He's rebuking Republican logic and laying bare their attempt to steal an election. Unfortunately, some damage has already been done. The rulings of these North Carolina judges have demonstrated their willingness to place politics before the law and signaled an openness to even the most ridiculous of legal theories that could overturn a legitimate election. Refusing to reject Griffin's lawsuit outright sets a dangerous precedent, and it gives Republicans a reason to try again in the future. They have destroyed their credibility in the most public of ways. No matter how this case ends, they cannot escape that. This was written by the editorial board of the News and Observer.
DOJ's damage makes way for serious government reform. This is a Bloomberg opinion. One way to hasten a long-delayed home renovation is to set the house on fire. Having helped torch much of the federal bureaucracy, Elon Musk says he plans to move on from his work at the Department of Government Efficiency. Here's hoping a sounder form of the civil service can now begin. DOGE began with much hype. It promised some $2 trillion in savings. Staffers vowed to quickly root out fraud and inefficiency, often wielding a chainsaw. Musk set about firing federal workers, canceling contracts, gutting programs, and dispatching a core of technology experts without government experience to root around in critical systems. Almost all of it backfired. Sweeping cuts of crucial employees, such as nuclear weapons experts, had to be reversed. Courts and cabinet secretaries raised objections. Chaos and confusion reigned across the government. Public opinion soured on DOGE, and Musk said he would step back significantly to spend more time on his business. As for the savings, DOGE's own estimates, now whittled down to $160 billion, have proved to be error-ridden and wildly inflated. One analyst found that the group's chaos will impose costs of some $135 billion this year, or more than 80% of the supposed savings. Another study found that cuts to the Internal Revenue Service would result in at least $350 billion in foregone revenue over a decade. It's likely, in other words, that this whole exercise has been a net negative for taxpayers. The shame of it is that Musk and company had identified real shortcomings. An overhaul of government technology is badly needed. Agencies really do waste a lot of money. Some fail in their most basic functions. Taxpayers can't help but notice when astronauts are stranded in space, faulty planes are cleared to fly, and the student loan system becomes all but unworkable. Not least, current government spending is completely unstable, yet Musk misdiagnosed the problems. Out-of-control spending is primarily driven not by fraud, but by entitlement programs, which DOGE hasn't touched. Addressing this crisis in the making is a job for lawmakers. Likewise, most of the bureaucracy's failures are due not to laziness, but to rules and procedures mandated by Congress. Extensive research has described the basic reforms needed: flexibility to upgrade the workforce, better access to the technology and data that workers need to accomplish their goals, fewer burdensome compliance tasks, and more incentives to think creatively. As Musk's involvement wanes, the priority for policymakers should be focused on such workaday improvements. The president has said he wants to keep the best and most productive people. Appointing Scott Cooper to lead the Office of Personnel Management is a good start. Cooper, managing partner at Andreessen Horowitz, says that he prefers a surgical approach to cutting jobs and wants to redesign the recruitment, development, and management systems for federal workers. He should be confirmed. Next, Congress needs to update the Civil Service Reform Act to build a workforce suited to the digital era. That means rewarding federal workers for showing initiative and producing measurable results rather than for box ticking. Staffers who deal directly with the public are often in the best position to see how and why government programs are falling short. Excuse me. They should be empowered to do something about it. Lawmakers also need to cut down on busy work. Agencies are required to submit thousands of labor-intensive reports annually, many of which are completely ignored. The Well-Meaning Paperwork Reduction Act has paralyzed efforts to design better government services and should be rescinded. The 2,000-page federal acquisition regulations should, let's say, use some simplifying. Such problems have persisted for decades, despite innumerable efforts at reform. If policymakers are interested in durable changes, they need to start doing things differently. Musk's exit is a good opportunity to get serious. And once again, this was by the Bloomberg Opinion.
This is our fourth opinion piece for today from the News and Observer by Isaac J. Bailey. This is in comment about Trump's first 100 days in office. This is what Isaac Bailey writes. I've never much cared for the 100-day presidential milestone. It's a contrived marker, usually with little significance. But this time feels different, given the fast-paced descent into anti-democracy during the second Trump presidency. There has been much to digest in so little time, making it difficult to encapsulate just what that change has been or where we're headed as a nation. The Trump administration is apparently adhering to the Steve Bannon doctrine of flooding the zone to make it impossible for the public to focus on any one event long enough to understand its long-term repercussions. Donald Trump's blinding supporters have been busy pretending he is just another president. They bombard us with frequent reminders of the past misdeeds of his predecessors to convince us there's nothing for which we should be concerned. We cannot afford to let that falsehood become the dominant narrative, even while we acknowledge that no president has been perfect and that some have committed quite awful acts. President Joe Biden's stewardship over our role in the still ongoing Gaza war bordered on the criminal, for instance. Trump wants you to blame Biden, who is no longer in power, for bad economic results, or think only of the good things Trump believes he's accomplished. But if you remember nothing else about this era, you must never forget what's happening in Lowndes County, Alabama. It illustrates the character of this president like nothing else has during his first 100 days and is the tenor of things we should expect for the rest of Trump's second term. Lowndes is a majority black county whose origins stretch back directly to slavery. It was formed in 1866, a year after the end of the Civil War, when black people were allowed to purchase land through the Southern Homestead Act. Most of those land purchases were in environmentally unsafe areas, activist Catherine Coleman Flowers told NBC News. The act was signed into law 4 years after the much better known Homestead Act, a law which all but excluded black people while handing roughly 270 million acres of free land to white people. An estimated 20 million white Americans still benefit from that Homestead Act. The residents of Lowndes are being affected by the Southern Homestead Act in a different way. They must contend with human wastewater in their homes and yards because of what Biden's Department of Transportation said amounted to environmental racism. It's gotten so bad over the years, a 2017 study found that about a third of the adults in the county suffer from an intestinal parasite known as hookworm. The Biden administration allocated $26 million to improve the county's infrastructure to save lives, improve others, and right a centuries-long wrong inflicted by the government. The state of Alabama didn't step up to help Americans in need, so the federal government filled that void. The project was underway until Trump signed an executive order killing it. Trump's assistant attorney general for civil rights said the project was just supposedly harmful DEI. I don't know if evil is the right word to describe such a statement, but it doesn't feel far off. The Trump administration is so hell-bent on reshaping the country in its ideological image, it is willing to lie about diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, even if it means directly endangering the lives of a vulnerable group of fellow Americans, is cruel and revealing. It's an extreme example of the administration's anti-blackness, which has always been the camel's nose under the tent for other forms of discrimination and cruelty. It makes it easier to cut FEMA funding while Western North Carolina tries to recover from Hurricane Helene. It makes it easier to ban books that make young people aware of the legacy of slavery that still shows up in places such as Lowndes County. It makes it easier to deport medically compromised toddlers and cut $1 billion in federal grants from mental health funding. The 100-day mark doesn't matter much, but it is sobering to imagine how much more damage Trump can inflict in the next 3 years, given the damage he's inflicted during the past 3 months. Isaac Bailey is a McClatchy opinion writer in North Carolina and South Carolina. Do we have another opinion piece?
We do. Senator Tom Tillis splits from Trump on Washington's top prosecutor. This is not from the opinion page in today's paper, however. Senator Tom Tillis is opposing the nomination of Ed Martin as Washington's top prosecutor. This would be the first time Tillis, a Republican from Huntersville, splits from President Donald Trump on one of Trump's nominees to help the president lead the country in his second term. Tillis has been an adamant critic of the attack on the Capitol by Trump supporters, which has put him at odds with Martin. At this point, I've indicated to the White House I would not support his nomination, Tillis told a hallway of reporters, first reported by CNN's Manu Raju and captured on video. Martin currently serves as interim U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia, a decision Trump made quickly after being sworn in. He then nominated him for the role permanently, but that requires Senate confirmation. Martin's term as interim U.S. attorney expires on May 20th, the 120-day mark, meaning the Senate Committee on the Judiciary needs to act quickly if it wants Martin to remain on the job. But with 12 Republicans and 10 Democrats on the committee, Tillis's opposition to Martin means that Martin won't receive more than an 11-11 vote, which would not allow his nomination to move to the Senate floor. Trump posted on Truth Social Monday night, urging senators to support Martin's nomination, saying Martin would be a big player in supporting his administration's health care efforts, led by Health and Human Services Secretary Kennedy. Martin's nomination was controversial from the beginning. He helped organize the Stop the Steal movement that advanced the false belief that former President Joe Biden did not win the 2020 election. It was this movement and that belief that led to the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. When Trump nominated Martin as the interim U.S. attorney, Martin immediately dismissed pending January 6 cases and fired prosecutors who worked on the case. Martin praised a January 6 defendant known for anti-Semitic remarks. He later denounced the man, Timothy Hale Cusinelli, but only after their ties became a source of opposition to his nomination. It was Martin's actions surrounding January 6th that drew Tillis's ire. I have no tolerance for anyone who entered the building on January 6th, and that's probably where most of the friction was, Tillis said. Tillis said their main differences are not over whether people should be charged, but for how long. That's an argument I'm willing to have, Tillis said, but we have to be very, very clear that what happened on January 6th was wrong. It was not prompted or created by other people to put those people in trouble. Tillis was one of the last people to leave the Senate chamber as rioters reached the Capitol. And Tillis reiterated Tuesday that he does not support the pardons that Trump gave to the January 6th defendants. Tillis told reporters he does not believe Martin's confirmation will even make it to a committee hearing.
Thank you. Good choice of an article to read there. This broadcast is generously supported by the Orchid Group at Morgan Stanley. We thank you, Morgan Stanley Orchid Group, for your contribution to the North Carolina Reading Service. You are listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. We are going to take a short break. We will return to our broadcast shortly. Thank you for being with us for our first hour. But don't go away, because we still have a lot more to read for you. We'll be back shortly. Thank you.